It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this first half hour is Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel was Barack Obama's Secretary of Defense in 2013 and 2014. If you recall, that was a period with several international conflicts, including the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It was also at the height of the war in Syria. Before serving as our country's Secretary of Defense, Hagel served Nebraska as a U.S. Senator from 1997 to 2009. And during that time, he established a reputation as an independent-minded, defense-oriented Republican. Chuck Hagel will be in Iowa next Monday, speaking at Simpson College in Indianola in the evening at 7 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. His talk is the 7th annual Culver Lecture that's put on by the John C. Culver Public Policy Center. And he joins me now by phone. Secretary Hagel, what a pleasure to have you on our program today.
Well, thank you all very much for having me. It's always a privilege to talk with anybody from the heartland, so thank you.
All right. Lots of points in the news that I'd like to get your perspective on. Let's talk about the WikiLeaks, the latest WikiLeaks, being called the largest leak of CIA documents in history, thousands of pages describing sophisticated software tools, techniques used by the CIA to break into smartphones, computers, even internet-connected televisions, what we call smart televisions. What do you see as the implications of this leak, as far as we know so far?
Well, first, I don't have any intelligence, and I know only what I hear and read. But that said, I served for 8 years on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And then after that, co-chairman of the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, then 2 years Secretary of Defense. So I say that, tell you that, because I do have some sense of some intelligence background of our agencies and our capabilities. If, in fact, what we think may have been lost in these WikiLeaks revelations, then it's significant. Again, not knowing any of the details on means and options and technologies used and methods used and so on, it could be very, very damaging. I think no matter what, it's going to be damaging. If for other no other reason, then it once again, to some extent, will erode the confidence that people have in our intelligence capabilities and the people who are responsible for keeping those secrets. It is never good for a country, for our country in particular, when these kinds of things get out. Now, I think the appropriate approach is what the Congress is doing. Both the intelligence committees in the House and the Senate are well underway on investigating to find out what exactly happened, why, what was lost. How does this happen? I mean, this hasn't been the first episode, as you know, of something like this happening. So it's a constant battle. It's not new, but it's a constant effort on the inside of any of our security enterprise institutions, certainly like our intelligence operations, to always try to stay ahead of technology and people and leaks, but it is never perfect and it'll never be 100%. But it could well be very, very damaging to our intelligence enterprise.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to those who would say, well, I'm glad that I know now that I can be spied on through my smart TV, even when it's not on?
I get that, and there is a side to this. The private liberties and rights of an American citizen versus the security interests of a country. I've always believed, I said this in the Senate when I was on the Intelligence Committee and Foreign Relations Committees, that we can do both. We have done both. But I am always most concerned about the liberties and rights of individuals enshrined in the Constitution, because history is rather replete on this point. Once you give any of those rights up to a government, regardless of the good reason or cause or effort behind it, and certainly the security of your nation is paramount, you rarely get those rights back.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned a few moments ago about the leaks and any administration having leaks, but leaks have been a major part of this president's, Donald Trump's, first few weeks in office. As someone who's been a major player in a previous administration, in the Obama administration, what does it tell you that this administration has so many leaks?
This administration, of course, as we all know, is new. It's, I think, in its sixth week. But I would answer your question this way. I would go back to the campaign of last year, and you recall, because you all covered it, a lot of commentary was made specifically by then-candidate Trump about he was glad, for example, about the WikiLeaks, which revealed John Podesta and the Democratic National Committee emails and all that followed. So leaks have been a part of the narrative here all last year and then going into this administration. I don't know if you can draw any conclusions, though, to your question about is this administration plagued with more leaks than any other, because this is an infant administration only in its sixth week, and this big one hits, of course, last a few days ago. And so then you get the other political dimensions of this, the president himself accusing his predecessor of bugging his offices and hotel in New York City, and then the other investigations going on about was there collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and then you got deeper into this issue with the confirmation hearing of then-Senator Sessions to be Attorney General, and however way you want to describe that, he had to change his testimony, acknowledging that, in fact, he had met with the Russian ambassador on two occasions, so on and so on. So my point is, leaks and all that go with leaks have been a very, very significant part of narrative, political narrative and government narrative as we go into this administration. Probably that should not, because of where we are now with the media leading almost every night their stories and newspapers with these kinds of issues, be surprising. But again, I think it's a little too early to tell, is this administration plagued with more leaks than the Obama or the Bush or Clinton administrations were? Until we get further into this administration, we won't know.
If you just joined us, my guest is former Secretary of Defense and U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel. He served as Secretary of Defense under Barack Obama. Let me ask you about something else in the news. On Monday, President Trump signed a new executive order on immigration. This is the revised order that bars citizens of six predominantly Muslim countries from entering the country, dropping Iraq from that list, but including also exemptions for residents of the U.S. and visa holders. Now, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the president's first so-called travel ban failed to prove nations listed posed a risk of terrorism. I don't know how you to what depth you've looked at this revision. Do you see a revised executive order here as an effective step in protecting the U.S. from terrorism?
Well, I start with this question: Is this and has it been a real problem? And the evidence that has come forth so far, and certainly what I saw in my previous positions, it was not a problem. In fact, terrorist acts being perpetrated here in the United States from immigrants coming to this country, that has not been an issue. That has not been a problem. The violent acts perpetrated in this country, especially those associated with terrorists, have essentially almost all been homegrown. So I'm not sure we've had a problem here.
But I mean, just to jump in there, if I could, Secretary, we have heard, though, arguments that we don't want to be in the position of Europe, where immigrants or refugees do conduct terrorism, sort of being ahead of the curve. Do you follow that argument? Do you buy that?
Well, of course I do. But let me finish my answer. What I just said was only one part of my answer. We have the most rigid system of checking people who want to come to this country of any country in the world. No country in the world is even close. We have essentially 21 steps that people who want to come to this country have to go through in order to get in. Is any system foolproof 100%? I've never known any, and I don't think there are. And so you're constantly, to your point, trying to range out of ahead of people who are trying to outsmart a system using technology or whatever. Of course, you must stay relevant to the changes and challenges of your day. But my first point is, this has not been a problem. This has not been a problem for our country. Does that mean it won't be a problem? Of course not. But we didn't come to this just today because President Trump brought it up as an issue. Every president we've had, certainly since 9/11, but even before that, but certainly since 9/11, and I was in the Senate at the time on 9/11, so I know what we did to change so much. And these intelligence agencies and TSA and all the other agencies that have responsibility for enforcing our laws and protecting us and our borders and immigration and so on, they're constantly ranging out over new methods, new ways, being alert. So, in fact, we don't have what happened to us, what happened to some of these other countries in Europe. But let me just add one last thing on the countries in Europe. I don't think you can at all equate what's going on in Europe and has been going on to what's going on here. First of all, those countries in Europe do not have near the capability and capacity we have with our enforcement systems. Their situation is totally different geographically to start with. I mean, as you have those Middle Eastern refugees flowing up from the Middle East into Europe, geographically, it's not easy to do, but it's far more simply than crossing an ocean. Mm-hmm. So when you add it all up, sure, we have a responsibility to protect the country. Every president knows that. Every secretary of defense, every head of any intelligence agency, every secretary of state, every president I've ever worked with, and I've worked with a lot of them and been in three administrations, they know that is their number one priority, security of America.
Chuck Hagel is my guest, former Secretary of Defense and U.S. Senator, a Republican senator from Nebraska, represented Nebraska for over a decade. He's coming to Iowa next Monday to speak at Simpson College. I want to get your views, please, on Russia. Russia has taken what current Secretary of Defense General James Mattis calls aggressive actions that have violated international law and are destabilizing. There's a consensus among U.S. intelligence agencies, you mentioned that a few moments ago, of Russian interference in our elections. How much should the U.S. engage with Russia? Do you think this administration has a clear or conflicted sort of messaging about how it will engage with Russia?
Well, first, on the first part of your question, engagement with Russia, absolutely. Great powers engage. We are the greatest power on earth. There is no power on earth even close to the United States, and you can apply any measurement metric to that equation that you wish. Economic power, military power, social power, corporate power, intelligence power, space power, satellite power. Nobody's even in our league. Now, that doesn't mean that that's the way it will always be, but great powers engage because engagement is in the interest of great powers. Engagement is not appeasement. Engagement is not surrender. Engagement is not agreeing with the other party. But when you've got a country like Russia that is our equal in the sense of they have the same nuclear capability that we do, you have to engage because we have so many mutual interests with Russia. Yes, the litany of events that you just noted that Russia has been responsible for, initiated, is all accurate. That's right. Ukraine violating missile defense treaties and so on. But you're not going to fix that, or the world doesn't get better, or the United States doesn't get safer by just saying, well, that's too bad. We'll show Russia. We just won't talk to them. That makes the world far more dangerous. In fact, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford, as you know, has just been in Turkey meeting with his Russian counterpart and his Turkish counterpart to talk about essentially not getting into an internal conflict, stumbling all over each other in Syria and killing each other, whether by accident or for other reasons. We have mutual common interests with Russia. We have mutual common interests with China. The world is too dangerous now. It's too complicated, too combustible, too interconnected. 7 billion people now on the face of the earth, and demographers tell us we're going to get to 9 billion by 2050. We live in a global community underpinned by a global economy. So you've got to deal with people.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Donald Trump's call for a 10% increase in defense spending? You just said nobody is in the U.S.'s league is in terms of military might around the world. I'm sure many listeners are saying, okay, we're in a league of our own, far powerful than any other state, so why do we need a 10% increase? Do you agree with that call that the president has made?
Well, when I was Secretary of Defense, I presented two budgets to the Congress, and those budgets were essentially constricted by, controlled by, what occurred and is now law 5 days after I became the Secretary of Defense in February of 2013, when sequestration hit. And for us at the Pentagon, it was not planned for, it was not budgeted for, and the Pentagon took another about a $40 billion hit in addition to the $50 billion hit we were taking year after year. There wasn't so the additional $40 billion hit was not planned for or budgeted. And it was a very difficult year for the Pentagon, having to find an additional $40 billion in cuts. We had to stop training, so on and so on. Well, anyway, we've been living with sequestration, and I said in the two budgets that I presented to the Congress, it needs to go. Every one of our commanders said sequestration needs to go, because if the United States people, if the citizens of this country who pay the bills, who should have the last word through their elected representatives on what kind of government they want, where their priorities are, if they demand more security, and all the things that come with that, and the costs, the expenses, the people, and so on, then they're going to have to pay for it. And if you want your Navy to be a 325-ship Navy and all the rest, and make sure that our interests are taken care of in the world, it's going to take some increases in the budget. Whether it's 10% or 8% or 5%, I don't know. I think those are somewhat arbitrary, but also it needs to reflect on what your policies are. Defense should never lead. Defense must never lead your foreign policy. I mean, security is the bedrock, as we've said, of course, of the main responsibility of any government, security of a nation. But that has to fit into a larger policy of where a nation wants to go in the world, meaning what is America's role in the world? What should we be doing? And the reason that we spend seven times more money on our defense budget than the next seven biggest spenders, including Russia and China and so on, is because we're the only country that's all over the world. There is no other country that has military capacity and capability worldwide like we do. And by the way, just so your listeners have some sense of this, more than half of the Defense Department budget goes for personnel, pensions, health care, all that take care of our men and women who serve and their families, and all that goes into the recruitment process of those personnel. Those costs are continuing to rise. And I would say one last thing on this, which most people don't recognize simply because they don't think about it. We have been in war now, this country, for the last now 16 years. If you're going to ask a professional military to continue to fight and continue to serve over and over and over combat tours like we did, Iraq, Afghanistan. Now we're back in Iraq, even with more soldiers going over, more soldiers going back to Afghanistan. Now we've got soldiers in Syria, a bunch more are going over here this week. We've got now people in different areas all over the world, and that takes a huge toll, personnel toll on families, on people, on everything that comes with that. Men and women break down like machines do. You just can't push people over and over and over. So what that means is you're constantly having to recruit quality people, good people. We've got a sophisticated military today. We've got a continuation of staying ahead in technology for sophisticated weaponry. The Chinese and the Russians use their military budgets not for their allies, not to protect anybody, or not to do good in the world. Their budgets are all about themselves. They don't have allies. Russia doesn't have any allies. China doesn't have any allies. But again, that's the burden America carries, and we may. And if America wants to review that, then they should. But I would add this, and I'll end this long answer with it. I've often said that with all the burdens that America carries, and there's unfairness to that. I get that. But in the end, the last 70 years of the world has been pretty peaceful. Unprecedented, we've not had a world war in the last 70 years with the sophisticated weapons that we have today. So if America decides they do not want to be the leading power in the world anymore, and we'll let somebody else pay that bill, then just understand this. The next great power in the world may not be near as judicious and benevolent with its power as America has been with our power the last 70 years. And that includes all the mistakes we've made. I think Iraq was a huge mistake. I think going into Iraq brought a lot of, if not all of what's going on in the Middle East today. I think it started that. Certainly Vietnam was that war I served in 1968. That was a big mistake. All the mistakes we've made, there's no country that's ever done as much good for its own people in the world as we have, and there's a burden you carry in order to accomplish that.
It's a conversation with former Secretary of Defense and U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel recorded earlier this morning. We'll wind up our conversation after a short break in just a few minutes. I'll ask the former Secretary of Defense what he would be looking at in the world as the major hotspots, the spots for international crises, if he were Secretary of Defense today. Also, ask him about the future of the Republican Party, his Republican Party. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, we'll talk with University of Iowa Associate Professor of Computer Science, Doug Jones. He's author of the book Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? But first, back to a little more of my conversation with former Secretary of Defense and U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel. He'll be speaking at Simpson College on next Monday in a lecture at 7 p.m. Back to that conversation with Chuck Hagel. Secretary Hagel, in your time as Secretary of Defense, as I mentioned at the outset, Russia invaded and annexed Crimea, and there's also the height of the Syrian conflict to look back on. When you look at the shoes that Secretary Mattis is in right now, what would you say, when standing in those shoes, as the most likely spots for serious international crisis in the world?
Well, I think the reality is that the world is as combustible, dangerous, unpredictable today, certainly as any time since World War II. We've not in our lifetime seen a time quite like this. Certainly North Korea, you've got to put that right at the top. The unpredictability, the dangerous dynamics that are in play with North Korea. You add to that the uncertainty, unpredictability, and the chaos going on in South Korea with the impeachment of their president. They essentially don't have a functioning government. China continues to be more aggressive in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, which is testing the United States and Japan more and more. The move to the Middle East, of course, where most of the Middle East is in either open warfare, conflict, chaos. You've got countries in the Middle East that essentially have non-functioning governments. Some countries in the Middle East have governments that are only functioning for 25% of their country. You've got the combustible mix in the Middle East of the Russians militarily very deeply engaged. You got the U.S. deeply engaged, the Turks deeply engaged, the Iranians deeply engaged, plus the element of terrorists, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and then the other players that are there. Just that combustible grouping makes for a very, very dangerous dangerous problem. Africa, North Africa continues to boil over. East Africa, these are probably right at the top of the most immediate and most dangerous parts of the world, where essentially anything could happen. And I would add, of course, to the Middle East, Iran, being a state sponsor of terrorism in along that the entire Persian Gulf. With the threat always of trying to stop something as far as shipping lanes and other threats, and in particular what Iran continues to do in Syria and Lebanon, and their, in many ways, de facto control over the Iraqi government, because Iraq is one of four predominantly Shia Muslim nations in the world. And so, again, you add all this up, Secretary Mattis and the president and all of the administration leaders are going to continue to have their hands full, just as President Obama did and I did and my colleagues when I was there.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the program, former Secretary of Defense, U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel. He'll be speaking in Iowa next Monday in the evening at 7 p.m. at Simpson College. It's free and open to the public. Secretary Hagel, we really appreciate your insights and your time, and we look forward to welcoming you to Iowa.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and thank you for the time.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The system was rigged. Now, that's a charge we heard often in the last election campaign. Both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders told us the system was rigged. They meant different things in using that phrase. This half hour, we want to get another perspective on our 2016 election and that aspect of it being rigged, purportedly. Doug Jones is with us, a University of Iowa associate professor in the Department of Computer Science. He's author of the book Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Doug, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Now, we're recording this conversation earlier on Thursday because you'll be speaking at noon at the Congregational Church in Iowa City before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. And the title of your talk, The Election 2016, Was It Hacked? So let's start off by asking you what points you'll be making.
Well, first I should say that I agreed to give that talk to the Foreign Relations Council last November. And at that time, I thought we might know the answers by now. But it's very clear the story is still in play.
It was after Election Day that you agreed to
right,
do.
Okay. Right.
And you thought, okay, we're going to get to the bottom of this, and then we'll have some definitive answers by the time I give my talk
right.
in March, right?
But the story is still in play. So I can only talk about the first half of the story. Up until now, it seems that things are still developing. We may find out someday what really happened.
Okay, so let's talk about what we know.
Okay,
what has been cleared up, or is clearer than it was in November?
Well, the system was rigged. Everyone agrees that, but the rigging is something that's quite out in the open. Every political party has a vested interest in creating a platform and creating a durable structure. And in that sense, every political party rigs itself to prefer candidates who represent that durable structure. And when you have an outsider candidate like Bernie Sanders or like Donald Trump, they're running against the system that's rigged against them. Mm-hmm. In the past election, Bernie Sanders came very close, and Donald Trump succeeded in overcoming that. And as a result, I think the Republican Party has changed quite considerably over the past year.
Mm-hmm. I think you're also referring to, Bernie Sanders
right.
working against the DNC here.
Exactly.
And there have been revelations there that Bernie had quite an uphill battle.
Right. And Trump had quite an uphill battle, and he knew it. And he managed to climb that hill. So in that sense, the system is rigged, but that's part of it's not a written constitution, but it's part of the way the system is constituted.
And it's really nothing new.
It's nothing new.
Okay.
And presidential elections in the United States, we can say they're rigged by the Electoral College. Because, for example, a voter in Wyoming's presidential vote is worth about twice the value of a California voter's presidential vote, because Wyoming has one congressional district and it's represented by three electoral votes, and California has, close to 30 congressional districts and is represented by about 30 electoral votes. Mm-hmm. So that Wyoming voter has really a heavily weighted favor. In Iowa, we're sort of in between. We have, 5-6 congressional districts. So we have a pretty heavy weight compared to those California and New York voters. The system is rigged in favor of small states, and that's written into the Constitution. And in fact, I think Trump actually benefited from that rigging.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what I'm concerned about.
Okay. What are you concerned
about? My concern is about the post-convention rhetoric about the rigged system. In that rhetoric, there's a sense in which by repeatedly saying the system is rigged, the system is rigged, the system is rigged, to his supporters, Trump may have authorized supporters to get down and dirty and fight back in a rigged system by cheating. The opponents are going to cast millions of illegal votes against us, so we are authorized to do anything. We can cheat too. If you get cynical about the system and you don't believe in its honesty, you have a license to cheat.
Or you just don't vote because you throw up your hands in despair.
Well, both things happen. And the question is, was the election honest? And this is a key question that we have to ask in retrospect. I think about every election we should be asking this question. Was this past election honest?
Mm-hmm.
I've been involved in questions of election integrity now for over 20 years, and looking at election integrity. And one of the ways you ask, is it honest, with any accounting system, and counting votes is accounting for votes, with any accounting system, one of the things we ask for is audits. And if someone's counting money, you'd like an auditor to step in once in a while and make sure they're being honest and not stealing some of that money. If someone's counting votes, you'd like an auditor to step in once in a while and make sure that the votes are being counted honestly. California instituted a system of election audits back in 1965, and they did this when they first permitted computerized vote counting in California. And in fact, the man who invented the punch card ballot also invented the system of auditing they use in California. After every election in California, they pick precincts representing 1% of the vote at random, and then they go back and they hand count the ballots from those precincts to make sure that the computerized voting systems didn't cheat. Auditing is a very powerful tool in its most general form. We can do much more than merely recount ballots. We can check that the ballots came from appropriate sources, that ballot boxes didn't get replaced on the way to the count. We can check to see that voters who the voting rolls say voted actually voted. And these kind of checks are done routinely in some jurisdictions. Auditing in the United States for elections fell by the wayside. Only California did it for years and years, until election 2000. And then a number of states, not the majority, but a number of states followed California's lead. In Minnesota, they audit 5% after every election. So they go back and do a hand count of 5% of the ballots.
And, of course, the 2000 election was the Bush v. Gore decision,
right,
before the Supreme Court was essentially decided by our Supreme Court.
Right.
Okay.
So in New York, they do 3%. There's been a lot of experimenting with auditing.
Let me remind our listeners, I'm talking with Doug Jones, speaking today before the Iowa Foreign Relations Council about election 2016, his perspective on it as a University of Iowa associate professor in the Department of Computer Science, also author of the book Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Let's talk about our president, Donald Trump's unfounded claims of illegal voting in November. Just after taking office, he repeated this in the campaign, but even after taking office, he repeated the claim that there were an unproven claim, by the way, that the millions of people voted improperly last year. Now, there was an investigation promised. That has not happened yet. Is there any evidence to support widespread voter fraud in the 2016 election?
No. In fact, the charge about millions of illegal votes, I have a friend who's a statistician in California, and he pointed out that if 500,000 illegal voters voted in California, then a random sample of something like 140 California voters has an 80% probability of finding at least one illegal voter. So all you've got to do is phone 140 people, track down 140 people who, according to the election rolls, cast votes in California. Look at the credentials of those 140 people and ask each of them, did you actually vote? And if someone's ballot was stolen or someone hadn't intended to vote and someone else voted in their name, you'd have a really high probability of finding them only looking at 140 people. Most of us encounter that many people in our daily lives. And so that the numbers that are being bandied about suggest that most of us probably know someone who voted illegally if that many illegal votes were cast. And Trump's charges are mostly aimed at California, saying that all, you know, that mm-hmm. big margin on the West Coast was all cheating.
Mm-hmm.
I find it just, you know, do the math. It's not that difficult to do the math. And if you do the math, you find that if the numbers are that large, then very small samples ought to be able to find evidence.
Mm-hmm. There's also the aspect there when this is queried, the supposed but unfounded voter fraud, that you get phrases like, well, they're dead people on the voting rolls, or they're people registered in several states.
That's a different problem. This is actually a very common feature of political rhetoric. There are facts on the ground, and those facts aren't always pretty, but they get blown into completely other forms. Our voter rolls in the United States are really not very well maintained. We have lousy voter registration databases. Anyone who ever volunteers for any political campaign to do some telephone calling knows that about a third of the phone numbers you call, that person doesn't live there anymore. That person has died. That person has moved away. That person just isn't there anymore. And doing phone calls for any political campaign, you'll have this experience. And this is because it's extremely hard to remove names from the voter registration lists. When people move from one state to another, they register in their new state, and they frequently simply forget about their old state, and they stay on the voter registration rolls there.
Mm-hmm.
County election officials try to get all the death notices and strike dead people from the rolls, but they don't always get all the death notices. They're not automatically in the loop for notices of death. So, yeah, there are a lot of dead people on the voter registration lists, and a lot of people are registered in two states. Those dead people don't get up and march to the polls and vote. And those people registered in two states, the vast majority of them don't cheat. There probably are one or two. There was a study done between Washington, D.C.'s voter list and Maryland's voter list. At fairly large expense, they did a cross-check on everything and found one or two people who'd cheated. It wasn't enough to make any differences in any election, and those people should be roundly scolded and fined for it.
Mm-hmm. But if you say we keep lousy track of our voting rolls in the United States, I mean, a democracy, we the people need to have confidence in the voting system that we have. So doesn't that mean even if there isn't an impact through widespread voter fraud or even minimal voter fraud, that we need to do something about this system because the confidence in it has been undermined?
Confidence has been undermined, and that is a problem. You know, we have lousy voter rolls, but people aren't cheating. I think this is a great credit to our country. I would like better voter rolls. I would like automatic transfer of voter registration when you move so that the state you moved from, it's not up to you to remember to tell your new jurisdiction to tell your old jurisdiction that you moved.
Doug Jones, before we end this conversation, I wanted to have you comment on placing the current times and the charges of voter fraud, unfounded voter fraud at the polls, that the talk was present in the last election, in some kind of historical context. Has there been a time in the U.S. when any elections were actually rigged, that ballot boxes were stuffed in a certain sense?
The last major conviction that I'm aware of for large-scale political machine activity was in 2008 in Clay County, Kentucky, when the Clay County political machine was taken down. The Clay County machine apparently was also involved in the marijuana trade and was involved in old-fashioned retail voter fraud, buying absentee ballots from voters who were willing to sell their ballots, paying voters to request assistance in the voting booth so that members of the machine would come into the voting booth and assist them, quote, in casting the right votes. And the Clay County machine was selling victory in local elections to the highest bidder. It was a very nice for-profit operation. But if you look back in the 19th century, Harrison County, Texas, had a period during which federal marshals took over the ballot boxes for federal elections. So they had two separate ballot boxes in each polling place, a federal ballot box and a state and local ballot box. All observers agreed the same number of voters that every voter cast a state and local ballot and a federal ballot. And when the polls closed, there are 30% more ballots in the state and local box. It's apparent that at least in Harrison County, Texas, about 30% of all votes cast were fraudulent. Mm. And this is, you know, the big city political machines, the Louisiana machine under the Long brothers, the bad old days of the Chicago political machine. Those were really corrupt systems.
Mm. Before we go,
one of the great questions for political scientists is, how did we move from a system where corruption was so dominant to a system where, by and large, we're pretty honest?
Mm-hmm.
I would love to find an answer, because it's an answer that much of the world needs.
You don't have an answer to that.
I have no easy answers.
Doug Jones, thank you for being with us. University of Iowa Associate Professor in the Department of Computer Science, author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Doug Jones speaking today before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And that winds up our program for today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And if you caught only part of the hour and want to listen to the entire hour, or you want to listen again, remember, we always have podcasts available after each broadcast. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River, available simply by going to iowapublicradio.org and search for River to River. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Our email address, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Join us again tomorrow. It's a NewsBuzz edition of our program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.